So it's so approaching men. We'll get back to that real quick. You got to do it. It's excellent practice. A lot of us feel more comfortable around men, or a lot of us feel really uncomfortable around men. Either both of those are excellent reasons to practice it. If you're in a public situation, if you're in a club or something like that, one of the best things to do is get a lot of the guys on your side, because those guys are also there trying to pick up women. And if you could talk to those guys and get them to like you, they might end up feeling, they might end up thinking, oh, that guy's too cool, and you know, he's talking to that chick, so I'm not even going to bother because he's awesome. Those guys are all are looking for women too, and if you're talking to some girl, one of them might have moved in and started talking to her too and picked her up. But whereas if they kind of know you and are kind of, you know, buddy buddy, oh, I was talking to that guy earlier, he's cool, they're gonna leave that girl alone. They go like, oh, he's got that girl, I'm not gonna, that, you know, let him have it. And so guys are easy, guys are fun, guys like stuff that you do possibly.
hold on, wait, time out. Dark Nemesis wants to know if you're a furry because you have cat ears on.
No, I'm not a furry. Excellent question. I will address that. I'm not a furry whatsoever. We'll get to why I have the cat ears in a minute, but I wore them a few hopes ago just all the time just as a peacocking gag, and I got to be known for it. And now it's to the point where if I come to Hope without the cat ears, people get pissed at me. And they go, Johnny Christmas, where's your cat ears, man? Fucking Hope! And so I have to wear them all the time now. I'm absolutely not a furry. I'm not into that at all. I get approached all the time by furries. I get approached all the time by gay men, because apparently the furry scene is also heavily homosexual. And no, not my thing. Thanks for asking. Thanks for allowing me to clear that up in the air. I totally understand where you're coming from because I get it all the time. So yeah, don't forget to approach men. Very, very important. And if you're more comfortable with that, do it. And if you're scared to death by other men, that's five times as good of a reason to do it. Let's talk about peacocking real quick. Peacocking is something that's mentioned in the game where a lot of people take it as
put on some cat ears and go out and pick up chicks.
Put on a feather boa and cat ears and look retarded, and chicks will just not stop having sex with you. It's not easy. Peacocking is an art. Peacocking is a means of making yourself stand out in a crowded room full of other men who kind of maybe look like you. You have to do something that works for you. If you do something that just plain looks retarded, you're just going to look retarded, and nobody's going to want to talk to you, or they're going to come up and pick on you. However, many women, regardless of what your peacocking thing is, will come up and pick on you, and they're being playful. Don't take offense to that. Don't call them a raving bitch and take a swing at them. If the second a word comes out of a woman's mouth that is directed to you, you already won that stage, and it's time to move on. You now have a girl that is talking to you. Start working it. Even if, you know, they come up, like these ears started as something peacocking. I had them around the house. I had longer hair before, and so when I put them on, it just looked like they were actual ears growing out of my head, and they were cutesy, and they're furry. Those who are watching the webcam stream can totally see these cat ears, and they kind of look weird with the headphones on. I like that. And women love things that are textured, anything tactile. They love fur, soft things, things with ridges, spiky things, anything textured. It's something with the female persona. The female psyche loves touch and feel. It provides an emotional response for them that men just don't derive from it. We started with boas, whether it's just like the cheapo cotton kind like this one I'm wearing, or ostrich feather. I love ostrich feather boas because they're real feathers, but they're real soft and frilly, and they flap. And women will come up, and they will... One of the things I love to do is try and touch my cat ears and pet them, and it's on at that point. As soon as they come up and interact with you, it's on. It's time to start working the game on them, and it's not a matter of just talking and being like, oh, hi, what do you do? Thanks for petting my ears. No, it's you have to constantly be playful. One of the biggest things I recommend to people who are looking to get in the game is to get a cat. Because women are very much like cats, in that if you approach them, they're going to ignore you, or they're going to run away from you. If you're like, hey, give me a hug to some stranger, they're going to be like, ah, get out, no. just like most cats. You go run up to a cat and go, hey, I'm going to pet you. They're going to run the fuck away. But if you sit at the couch and go, oh, what's up, cat, and then ignore it, eventually that cat's going to come up and be like, hey, hey, me, hey. And if you pet it a little bit and then go back to watching TV, it's going to be like, no, 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 pet me, pet me, pet me, pet me. And a lot of women are very much like that. So don't be overbearing. Treat them like cats. So the cat ears worked very well because women would like to come up and try and pet them or grab them. And one of the fun, most fun things to do, and this works with anything tactile, boas are really good, is you pull it away and you go, hey, hey, hey.
Good girls don't grab.
Good girls don't grab. And that's one of our all-time favorite ones. Good girls don't grab. Almost always your immediate response to them will be, who said I'm a good girl? And there you go. Now you've already progressed another level into playful flirting. Just with two sentences. Or go, hey, hey, you know, that's $20. Or, you know, whatever. But, you know, you have to play hard to get. Don't be a dick. Don't be an outright asshole. Don't wave them off. You know, if they go and grab you, don't go, hey, get the fuck out of here. I don't know you. That's not, don't, it's, you have to be playful, not angry. You know, be a douche, not a dick.
Okay, wait, this mic screwed up. Yeah, the whole douche and dick thing.
Yeah.
Wait.
No, you're all right.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
It's basically, there's a big difference between.
Oh, that is screwed up.
There's a big difference between being, like, basically cocky funny and being a douche a-hole.
Yeah.
And that's what we got to keep in mind. This mic sucks.
Yeah, I got you. So I'll extrapolate on that. Yeah, cocky funny, not pretentious dick. You know, you're not there, like, you have this air about you that you're better than everyone, but you don't go telling everyone that you're better than everyone and ignoring them and making them feel like shit. It's an art.
Okay, guys, sorry to jump in here, but it looks like the panel's about to start.
Okay.
The informants, villains or heroes. So, do you guys have a couple people PM'd me saying that they wanted to, like, do you guys have any advice on some websites they can go to, or do you guys got your own thing going on that some people can look at?
No, I really don't recommend websites at all, personally. There's just, because
give them one of our emails, and we'll follow up with people individually, or we'll be on the channel the rest of the weekend. Like,
yeah,
we'll
you
set
know
something up.
I don't mind doing that. Go ahead and
I'm gonna go switch over to the stream now. But when you guys come out, I'll give you some.
Yeah, I'll hop on. I'm going to hop on Radio Statler in the chat room right away. And,
okay.
And we'll address it for a little bit in there.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, sorry we got cut short. I totally screwed up and booked way too short of a time. It is my fault. We'll absolutely be back next hope, probably with.
Yeah, don't blame me.
I think we'll do probably a full on talk in one of the tracks with something more better. Okay. So Johnny Christmas and Cobalt Infinity signing off. And now we return you to your regularly scheduled Hope Conference.
The question that I think we need to ask here today is, why do people do this? Why does this happen? What gets into someone's head with them do something like this? And what would you do in a similar situation? And can you judge somebody that you have not been in their shoes? Very quickly, I'll tell my story, and then these two will tell theirs. Back when I got into trouble in the mid-80s, hacking into NASA and the White House and various other things via GTE's telenet system. The unfortunate aftermath of that was that federal agents descended on the radio station that I worked at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. And that caused all kinds of confusion because, well, first of all, I didn't own a computer at the time. I wasn't seen to be a suspect, so I had to actually tell the federal authorities who the suspect was. It wasn't the guy on the computer, it was the guy who was actually using the computer, so, you know, send your subpoenas this way. After that happened, I noticed people started acting kind of strange because, well, when federal agents are lurking about, people get scared. People have all kinds of unpredictable reactions. And the thing I noticed most, well, first of all, a lot of people stopped talking to me, and I guess that's something that happens whenever you're under investigation by some kind of law enforcement agency. People kind of freak out and they say, I don't want to be seen with him because I could be busted for something else or guilt by association, whatnot. So there are those people who stopped talking to me. But then there was one person that I found out later, because other people didn't know how to keep their mouth shut. I found out that this guy had gone to the university legal people and volunteered information, volunteered things that he had heard me say that might make me somewhat suspect, and maybe I'm up to something more, because the federal authorities were very interested in who I was, what I was doing. And at the time, I was floored. How could somebody do this? Why would somebody who's not under investigation themselves voluntarily go to somebody and turn in evidence, or what they think is evidence, or suspicion, or gossip, or whatever, without any reason to? I mean, we were friends. This was somebody I talked to, somebody I saw every day. And again, the only reason I found out was because some idiot in the university office told somebody else, and it got back to me. And yeah, I was pissed off as hell when this happened, because this guy's screwing me over for no reason. I never did anything to him, and it's like a witch hunt now. I mean, I was very open about what I did. I even went to the feds and told them so that somebody else wouldn't get in trouble for it. And here are people looking to make it even worse. It was very, very hard for me to understand this at the time. Afterwards, I tried. I tried hard to put myself in their shoes and understand what they must have been thinking when they did this, and how scared somebody can be just at the sight of a cop, at the sight of a federal agent, and who knows what demons they have lurking in their closet. People panic. People panic and do things that we don't understand why they do it, and the authorities count on this. The authorities live for this kind of thing so that they get as much information, they get all of us telling other people about other people. This is how every authoritarian government in history has worked, by getting their citizens to spy on each other and report to the authorities, and then more people do it to them. So without the dialogue, and that's what I hope we accomplish here today, the dialogue where we actually try and understand where we're all coming from, maybe we can prevent this kind of thing from continuing to happen. But right now, and as you'll hear with some of the stories today, this is a part of our community that has always been there. The amount of people who turn into informants, the amount of people who turn people in, the amount of people that you think you can trust with information that you really can't, that has always been with us, and likely will be for quite some time. Kevin, what do you have?
Yeah, I had issues with informants as well. And
did you?
Total issues, yeah. First of all, the way the federal authorities work is it's a divide and conquer. So what they want to do is, if they could find more than one person involved in a case, what they'll do is they'll try to turn the other person to what they call a cooperator. So, and the benefit of that, obviously, is the person gets a reduced sentence, or under the federal sentencing guidelines, they get what they call acceptance of responsibility. So in essence, what the informant or the snitch is actually getting paid with, you know, not money, but less time in exchange for their testimony, which I have a problem with, because if a jury found out that somebody was paid $10,000 to testify, or they were paid with 1 year less in prison, to me it's the same. So they actually get paid for their testimony. In my personal experience, when I first hacked, and this is right out of high school, I was 17 years old, I became involved with this group of guys, and they knew much more about the RISC-DC operating system. In fact, they actually were the administrators of the system for the Los Angeles Unified School District. And at the time, I was into phone phreaking. I didn't really care much about hacking. I was more had a very passionate feeling towards telephony. And I wanted to join this group. So what they did is, they had their initiation was like an impossible task. They had a colleague that actually worked for Digital Equipment Corporation on the RISC-DC development team, and they told me for me to be able to join their group, I had to break into RISC-DC development at DEC. And I said, well, how can I do that? Well, we're going to give you the dial-up number. So they gave me the dial-up number, and at the time, you know, the only thing you could do is either guess passwords or use social engineering at that point. So I actually used social engineering. I was able to get in. And then what these guys did is they immediately went down to an office that actually had faster modems, you know, like 1,200 baud, because back then we had 110, 300 baud. So they went down to their office, 1,200 baud, and they're actually copying the source code to the RISC-DC operating system. And I was kind of watching them do this. And then I found out later, after they finished this task, they actually called Digital Equipment Corporation and told them, I'm the one that hacked in, after they stole all their source code. Fortunately, I was a juvenile at the time, and nothing actually happened to me. I was never approached by the authorities. But later on in life, I chose bad hacking partners. And there was a guy named Lenny DeSico, and he and I always had contests against each other. So I worked at a company, he worked at a company, and we'd have a challenge. If we could hack into each other's systems, like capture the flag, we would the reward would be $200. So I kept getting into his system at work, but he could never get into mine, and he got angry. And then one time, and then it ended up becoming a situation where he actually went to I did some pranks because we had a little falling out over this, and he actually went to the FBI and told them all the hacking we were doing in Digital Equipment Corporation, because at that time we were copying the VMS source code. So here's a guy that wasn't even under investigation or anything at that point, and because he was angry with me, went to the federal authorities and became an informant. But because he didn't get a lawyer or discuss this with an attorney, what had happened is he actually ended up getting himself convicted of a felony. Yeah, which was really stupid. He was just so angry, he ended up, now he has a felony on his record. So then later on, then I got involved with another guy, and he was in the fugitive game. Those that have read the book, there's a guy named Louis DePayne. He and I were hacking partners for over 20 years. And in the fugitive game, because John Littman got input from him and not really the authorities, when they went and searched his apartment, in the book it's portrayed as he was one up on the FBI, that he was not being cooperative at all, and he was being antagonistic, and that he knew all about their operation, which he knew a lot about their operation, but in the book it appeared he was like non-cooperative and a smartass to the government. But in reality, when I got my discovery, what they call FBI 302s, this is when somebody interviews with an FBI agent, they fill out these FBI 302 forms. When I got that in my pretrial discovery, after 4 years, by the way, I found out that that really wasn't the case. That was that as soon as they got into, searched his apartment, he immediately offered cooperation if the government could provide him protection, like I was going to do something. But so in all my cases, except for the last one of Sutomo Shimomura, they all involved informants. And in one case, it was a guy that had a vendetta against me. The second case was a guy who was under investigation with me. Myself, when I was sitting in custody, there was the Free Kevin movement, I was offered to cooperate. Because what happens is how the government wants to work the cases is they want somebody to be able to testify against the other, and they want to divide and conquer both, all the parties in a conspiracy. But at the time, I refused to cooperate because I felt it was against my ethic and moral fiber to reduce my sentence to hand it off to somebody else. I just felt really uncomfortable. So I sat in prison much longer than I normally would if I would have had to cooperate, but I feel good today knowing that I didn't hurt somebody else. I didn't try to reduce my sentence to harm another individual. And it even got to the point where the government said, okay, you don't have to cooperate against somebody else, but we want to debrief you. And I even refused to allow the government to debrief me. So what ended up happening is I actually served out like the full sentence. I didn't get any points for acceptance or responsibility or anything of that sort. But what I think what's also interesting, there's a way to detect formants in the federal system. There's a computer system called PACER, Public Access Court Electronic Records. And this allows you to look up docket reports of people that have been charged with federal crimes. Also civil, you have bankruptcy there. So in knowing how the system works, because I was inside the system for quite some time, I could look at a docket and
kind of get a good sense of whether that person is cooperating against another individual. And let's look up an example. I'm not saying this particular person's an informant, but it's highly suspicious, some of the circumstances in their docket. So let's take a quick look. Can you bring it up on the projector? Yeah, bring up my...
Which session is it here?
It's under...
Is this somebody who's in prison now?
No.
Okay.
But
I don't want someone getting shanked because of something we say.
Where is it? Wait, right here. All right. So here's a docket report off Pacer, and anybody could sign up for Pacer and analyze these things. So I just picked just a random guy. This guy's named Gregory D. Evans. Okay. And let's analyze the docket here.
What does that mean, terminated?
That means the case, it doesn't mean he's terminated, it means the case was finished.
I don't know the
finished.
If all our problems were that easy.
So this is the case for the Central District of California. Now, let's look at some like suspicious things you could see in a docket. Well, first of all, we see that this individual was sentenced to 24 months on the right-hand side under the disposition. But let's go down. Now, in the news media reports, I actually Googled this guy, and this guy actually had a co-defendant. What's suspicious is the co-defendant's not on the same docket. In a normal federal case, when they prosecute an individual, they have to try them together if they're part of the same conspiracy. So if they're not on the same docket, that means there's something as strange is going on. But let's look further, because that's not conclusive by itself. So if we look that he was charged with an information, and these are numbered, and I'll go through the numbers. One, he was charged with an information. Then he was indicted on number four. And he was assigned to this judge named Dick Trevisan. Okay, in number eight, the government requested detention. What that means is they want to hold this person without bail. Okay, because they're either a flight risk or a danger to the community. So if we go down a little bit further, in number nine, he immediately decided to plead guilty. That means there's no presumption of evidence that he is actually guilty of some of the charges in the indictment or the information. So then, we go down a little further, and if you look at number 17, there's a notice of filing under seal by his attorney, meaning that this is not for public consumption, and and the government could obviously see it, but it's a notice filing under seal. And then immediately after this under seal filing, and there's several of them, in number 28, all of a sudden he's getting bail. They're allowing him to bond out of prison. Now, that doesn't make sense. If you haven't been found guilty by a trial or pled guilty, right, the government didn't want him out. They basically wanted to detain him. Now the guy pleads guilty. There's several under seal filings, and all of a sudden he's getting bail? I mean, what do you think? No, it's not conclusive. So there's the securities, there's the property he's putting up. And now, if you look at 33 down this whole list, it's all in-camera under sealing filings by the defense. Right? So usually what this... I'm not sure in this particular guy's case, but in a lot of cases, it's when the attorney, they're talking about the cooperation that person is doing with the government. So another thing to look for is long delays after pleading guilty or pleading guilty before that in sentencing. If there is several months in between, it's usually normally 90 days. Because in a federal criminal case, they have to do, the U.S. Probation Office has to do what they call a pre-sentence report. In the pre-sentence report, the probation department recommends a sentence. That's a 90-day period. But when it goes on for months, what that means, well, it could likely mean, look at all these under seal filings. What that means is there's a reason why there's a delay between adjudication of guilt and sentencing, and that usually indicates that that person may be cooperating against another defendant or more than one defendant. So it's kind of interesting because in my personal case, I don't know if you know this, there is a guy named Justin Tanner Peterson, who went under the name of Agent Steele. And what this guy was doing is he was actually committing credit card frauds. And he was involved in the Kevin Poulsen case. He ran off to Texas. He got busted again for fraud. As soon as he ended up in jail, he calls Pacific Bell and the FBI in Los Angeles and offers to become an informant against the hacker community. And his job was to get the bust or to acquire evidence against as many people as he possibly can. And I became one of the large targets. After he was able to help the government get Kevin Poulsen's computer in the prosecution against Kevin Poulsen, his next target was me. So if you looked at his docket on PACER, it essentially has the same pattern. Numerous under seal filings by the defense, bonding out after pleading guilty, long delays between adjudication of guilt and sentencing. So you kind of work out just by kind of a traffic analysis who's an informant or not. So I think that's quite interesting. I don't know what else to say. You know, I had issues with people informing against me in several instances. I never became an informant against people in my federal cases because, again, I felt that was the wrong thing to do. And I think in some cases you have to look to what the person is doing. If you knew your next-door neighbor was killing children and burying them in the backyard, would you inform against that person? Probably, right? You know, if somebody's killing people, right? Probably. But I think there's...
Probably?
Yeah, probably, yeah, probably. Like, for sure. Yeah, so... So, I mean, you got to look at, well, what is that person really doing? It's very subjective. And then how do you handle, if you go and inform against the serial killer neighbor and you go off and your intention is just to do it to, for example, read about the situation in the media or something like that, maybe that's the wrong reason. Maybe if the reason was really to protect other kids from being victimized by this fictitious serial killer, you know, maybe that's a better reason. One of the best reasons, you know, maybe is if you have to protect yourself. For example, if I were to come to you, for example, and admit that I just robbed the bank across the street, technically, if the government found out that I told you and you had knowledge of that, you're what they call an accessory after the fact.
Or misprision of a felony.
Yeah, misprision of a felony, which means you could be prosecuted and sentenced for the same behavior as what you attempted to conceal.
Okay. So, I hate to break in. We have a lot of ground to cover. We have a 90-minute panel today, which is great, but we have so much to cover and so many people to talk to. Just joining us is Fiber Optic. Some of you may remember him. Yeah. And there's more coming, too. But right now, Bernie, if you could briefly give some slight presentation here, and we'll keep moving. What's that?
Oh, that's the... there's part of our federal government called the United States Sentencing Commission, and they come up with deciding how long people should be locked up for various deeds. And it's all broken down to a formula. It's amazing what an infrastructure we have for this sort of thing. But that's a sentencing table. And if you look further down, you'll see that, along the vertical axis of the sentencing table, you see a base offense level, which is a number from 1 up to, I think it goes up to like 43. And then along the horizontal axis of the chart is a criminal history score, depending on your prior offenses, whether misdemeanors or felonies, that's scored as well. And where they intersect is a range of months that the federal government will put you in prison. You can see the low end is like 0 to 6 months, and then at the high end you have 210 to 262 months, or in the lower right-hand corner you see a bunch of things that have letters in them, like 360 months, which is like 30 years, to dash LIFE, 30 to life. I spent a bunch of time in U.S. Marshals custody waiting for go to court hearings in the federal building in Philadelphia, and guys would come back from their trials or whatever, and you know everybody would ask, well, what'd you get? And they'd come back, I got letters. And that meant, it's a young guy you're just talking to, 20 years old, and you just found out he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison for whatever. You don't ask what they did or accused of. It's not polite. It's not bad form. But it has an impact on you. You just meet a young person who just said they got letters. So anyway, This is what the federal government hands out to people. And when people know they're facing this sort of thing, what you think you normally would do in a situation sometimes goes out the window. So that's the sentencing guidelines. When people are facing that, they also sometimes will get what's called a proffer letter. The federal government will, open this thing up here, send you a letter saying, hey, we maybe not haven't charged you yet, but you're a person of interest, and if you tell us some information here, we will give you various kinds of immunity, so you won't get prosecuted for things as long as you tell us about everything. And if someone's looking at letters or smaller numbers, but significant numbers locked in a cage, you might consider doing that. I'm not suggesting that, but I'm just saying that's the kind of pressure that people can be under. And here's a copy of a proffer letter from the Department of Justice to somebody. This is just one I found random at Google. And I also wanted to show what the federal government... bear with me here a second. There it is, 5K1.1. Here we go. Downward departures. In the federal sentencing, I call this all the part of the informant infrastructure of our government, our country. You see something called substantial assistance to authorities, or 5K1.1. And basically it says, and you can go into all the details here. You can look up 5K1.1 under USSG, United States Sentencing Guidelines. Basically, it says your sentence will be less, often considerably less, if you provide substantial assistance to authorities. In my own case, or cases, I had a state misdemeanor case and then a federal felony case, and they were tied together. I was initially charged with tampering with evidence, and that was allegedly removing batteries from a touchtone dialer. I know, pretty serious. And also having something to do with the disappearance of an instruction sheet that explained how to use a tone dialer. And I was with myself, we were at a ham radio flea market, actually, myself and two people I knew. Actually, one person I knew and his friend came along. The car was parked in a place that the police wondered why this car was parked. And the car just sort of searched the car illegally. The police just searched the car because there was a broken window. They thought it was a stolen car. It wasn't, but they searched through it and they found a couple of tone dialers in the car. And they were like, so then they were like, this, what is this? So they did some investigation. They took back to the police station once we came back to get the car, and we were in holding area, waiting for them to decide what they were going to figure out to charge us with, if anything. And that's when the batteries disappeared from a tone dialer, and the instruction sheets also disappeared. And ironically, the tone dialer in question, it wasn't my tone dialer, and the instruction sheet did not go into my underwear, it went into somebody else's underwear. I kept my mouth shut about any of that. But I was unwilling to testify against anyone else, and I was the person whose car it was, so they charged me. They said, if you don't even tell who was involved with this, then you're going to be charged. And they came up with some misdemeanor that was going to, like, there's some Pennsylvania misdemeanor that says if you possess something that could be used to commit telephone fraud, then that's a misdemeanor. But they couldn't charge me with, they couldn't prove he could do that, so they just charged me with the tampering with evidence, because I wasn't going to say, well, he did that, he took the batteries out and he put the instructions down his shorts. So I kept my mouth shut, it was my car, so I took the charge. Ironically, one of the guys, well, I don't know if it was ironic, but one of the guys, my friend's friend, was a co-defendant in a fiber optics case. I didn't know that at the time, but he did tell me he was under probation or parole or something, so I didn't want him to get in trouble. So in any case, so...
That friend later turned out to be an informant.
Yeah. I didn't know. I just knew he was a hacker guy, but I didn't know he was a significant informant in this case. That happened actually before he informed on Fiber's case before this thing happened with me. But I didn't know that they were connected. In any case, a year or so went by, and then this thing with the Secret Service came up with me. And to make a long story short, after I was arrested for possessing hardware and software that could be misused, according to government, for the unauthorized access to telecommunication services, a newspaper article appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer, which alerted someone who I was here with at the very first Hope Conference, who he and I went in on a deal where I would purchase a bunch of quartz crystals and he would purchase a bunch of really small tone dialers. And he sold the tone dialers on that end of this room, and I sold crystals on this side of the room. And then people built red boxes with these parts. And
it's another page of history in the Hotel Pennsylvania.
Right in this room. I was like right here, where we didn't have the stage right here. We had, this is like a big expo room for the first Hope. But anyway, sold a lot of crystals, like it cost for like a dollar, and it was just basically as a community service to the hacking community here. But in any case, many months later, when this article appeared in the Inquirer, he saw this and he freaked out. He called, and what he was doing, he was actually building and selling red boxes. I had never sold a red box to anybody. I was never charged with selling a red box to anybody. I wasn't even charged with using a red box, but it's besides the point. The point is, when he saw that, he freaked out. He called the police, and they said the Secret Service involved, so then he called the Secret Service. And despite him having sold a bunch of red boxes to like co-workers, he was a Philadelphia public school teacher, he sold them to all his co-workers, that sort of thing. Despite that level of culpability, the Secret Service, who had sort of motivation to punish me for things that had nothing to do with tone dialers, had to do with distributing surveillance photos of some other undercover agents. And this comes from my prosecutor, who told my lawyer that this is the real reason I was locked up. In any case, they gave him enough. They gave them enough information to put a case together. It's one thing when a government agency can, for law enforcement agency can, they can figure out what's going on, but they have to prove it, you know. And it's helpful when they have someone testify against you that's much stronger evidence, and they can say, well, obviously he was doing this and this because he had this. So,
Bernie, do you think that person was afraid of what they were doing? They were selling red boxes, you said, so they came forward so that they wouldn't get in trouble.
Yes.
And fingered you.
Absolutely.
And you were the bigger enemy because you were actually teaching people things and speaking out and being a lot more intelligent than just a common criminal.
Yeah, I wasn't hiding this. I was publicly showing people here how to rebuild red boxes at the first Hope Conference and at 2600 meetings and other stuff. So he, knowing that I was now locked up, was afraid that I was going to rat him out. It always was like you said, it's a divide and conquer thing. People are afraid who's going to rat who out first. So I was just taking responsibility for my own actions, and I was not about to name anybody else, even though I got a proffer letter later on and all this. I take responsibility for my own actions. But he decided he wanted to relieve himself from punishment. And I got an apology letter from him a year later saying, yeah, I hope you understand what I did, and I'm sorry, but, you know, I've got a wife and kids and a job, and I hope you understand. And then he went on just, like, small talk after the letter. I'm like, what the hell is this letter? You know, it's like, go away. I don't want nothing to do with you anymore. So these people, they seem to just justify why they do this. But as a result of him doing that, he got complete immunity, even though his actions were, he was more culpable in committing criminal offenses than I was, but he got nothing. So I don't begrudge him getting nothing, but I do have a problem with how he arrived at that result. Let's see, I just want to make one more point. No victims. Oh yeah, the federal government and the state government in both my state misdemeanor and the federal felony cases. In both cases, they put in writing that there were no victims in my offenses. Yet, you know, you can still, despite there's no victim in your case, you can still spend serious time in prison.
You became a victim for well over a year.
Well, I mean, not technically a victim, but I, you know, I spent a good year and I went through a lot of trauma and so forth. But, you know, it's kind of ironic, you know, and you're standing before a judge and you have to apologize. And typically, you're expected to apologize to the judge for the people that you harmed. And I was, like, really short on words. Like, what do you want me to say that the government said I didn't do anything, but I just don't want to hear that. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to look humble and whatever that. So, and I don't want to say, well, I'm the victim, but yeah, whatever. All right. So this kind of stuff happens. But it's funny that amusing that our cases, fibers in mine, were indirectly linked because someone who was culpable in a case that I was involved in ended up prior being an informant in Fiber's case.
Well, Fiber, I'd like for you to tell your story quickly, and it's because we have a lot of ground to cover. And Fiber Optic.
Thanks. With due respect to Condor, I bet you haven't been called Condor in a while, and Bernie S., for pointing out a lot of the legalese that we've been obliged to learn for our own protection, I want to take a few moments to rewind a little bit and speak on behalf of our rules that we lived by in our community long before the FBI and Secret Service succeeded in infiltrating our community. These things probably aren't spoken aloud very much anymore, and at the risk of sounding cliche, I won't refer to them as the hacker ethic, since that's become something in a movie script. What I will say is this, is that we've always spoken of the quest for knowledge as being most important in our pursuits, that this was always a noble cause, that the destruction of systems, crashing systems, was always something that we avoided doing at all costs, whether by accident or as a joke. It was something that was always frowned upon. The fact that information about technology should be freely available was something that we always held to be of great importance. We always frowned upon companies who charged charged money for technical documentation and information about operating systems, which was very hard to find in the 1980s, for example. Which is why trashing and things of that nature were so popular. A lot of the times was to find manuals on how to use the systems that we were getting access to. And then probably above all else, there was the notion of trust, which is extremely important when you consider the fact that at that time, there wasn't any internet to speak of. We were communicating via bulletin boards, in most cases, bulletin board systems with a single phone line with a single modem that we were sort of competing with each other to get through busy signals, just to get in, read some messages, and respond to some messages. That was basically how we communicated with each other back in the 1980s. The things that we were doing, while a lot of them originally were not illegal, they would become illegal through the modification of laws due to the complaints of big business to the government to crack down on hacking. Many of these laws were enacted around 1986, but they wouldn't really be tried officially until a few years later. The trust that we always assumed was existent between our fellow man, obviously, as you can see from the stories of Kevin and Bernie, was not the case, and certainly would kind of fall apart over time as the government became more involved in hackers and in prosecuting hackers. Hackers are human beings as well, and we began to see this our trust model basically fall apart. Since we were hacking the reason why we had these handles in the first place was not because we were playing cloak and dagger games. It was because we were doing things that were illegal and we needed to protect our personal identity. And this was mutually respected between hackers. For a hacker to even to divulge the identity of another hacker to other hackers was frowned upon. To give information about what a hacker was doing to the feds, to volunteer this information, was unheard of. The fact that it's so easily done today for personal gain or to avoid prosecution is really a self-serving behavior that simply didn't exist back then. And it's unfortunate that things have changed to this degree. There have been many people who have come about over the years who were wholly self-serving. Kevin's example of Justin Peterson is a prime example, and unfortunately he's not here to defend himself because he's dead. Justin Peterson actually died a couple of months ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, recently.
Yeah. I'm not dancing on his grave or anything, but other people might. Justin actually used to, I knew Justin from BBS's in the late 1980s, and he used to call me up quite frequently, and we used to discuss hacking switches. The only reason I can imagine, and I knew he was on the run supposedly, and doing things of a questionable nature. I didn't know that he was informing on people, least of all Kevin or Kevin Poulsen. When I met the California hackers in the early 90s and we sat down and discussed exactly what it is Justin did, it became apparent to me what had happened. But much of what Justin knew and did with switches in and around California and I guess elsewhere when he was on the run, I hesitate to say he learned from me. The only reason I can imagine he didn't inform on me personally is because I was such a good source of information to him, which is unfortunate because had I known what he was doing, certainly I would have hesitated to talk to him. But again, I knew him from bulletin board systems and had no reason to doubt the veracity of what it is that he was telling me. How many people here are familiar with the gang war in cyberspace, LOD versus MOD?
Wow, look at that.
Oh, look at that. Okay. Never happened. Would it surprise you to find that out, that it never happened? There was no war in cyberspace. There was never a war between LOD and MOD. It was a complete fabrication.
But it was in the mass media.
That's true. It was in the mass media. That means it must be true, right?
I read it in the newspapers.
Yeah, all these guys read it. It was a fabrication by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the media people that I was friends with when I was indicted thought it was completely ludicrous and didn't report it as such. Other journalists of, let's say, lesser journalistic integrity latched onto the story because it made great print. Gang war in cyberspace. It was like literally the West Side Story of the hacker underground. We got the rich kids in Texas versus the inner city kids in New York. I mean, what better story to tell? Let's write some books, print some articles, write some magazine articles too, and, you know, do some photo spreads, and, you know, it makes for great copy. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. What I will say is that there was a great amount of disagreement and dissension within LOD in the late 1980s, because of the fact that there was informing going on. Several people, several members of the Legion of Doom had gotten busted under mysterious, let's just say mysterious circumstances. People that we knew, people that we were affiliated in other countries, for example, a hacker group in Australia, were busted under suspicious circumstances, which all led to a certain individual that we all know and love in Texas, who had started one of the first hacker consultancies under the auspices of gaining clout with the FBI and telco security. The person I'm referring to is Eric Bloodaxe, in case it wasn't clear to anyone in the audience. He actually was a member of LOD. LOD was one of the first organized hacker groups in a very disorganized computer underground. And the main purpose of LOD initially was to take information, primarily that was found trashing at telco central offices, and type it in and make it available in what were known as LOD tech journals, which were available online in text file sections of bulletin board systems, so-called elite bulletin board systems, that required a certain amount of trust to gain access to. I see some people in the audience that were involved during those times that remember this.
Don't worry, we won't rat you out.
Yeah, thanks. What happened towards the late 1980s when there were things like Operation Sun Devil, which had nothing to do with LOD directly, there was EFF was formed, EFF got involved in my case, in some of the other hacker cases at the time. There was a lot more government involvement in the hacker underground in general, and because of that fact, two things happened. A lot of people who had not gotten in trouble yet didn't want to risk anymore. They were already older, particularly the older generation of hackers. Some guys that I knew who started LOD, for example, withdrew from the hacker underground, simply didn't want to risk getting in trouble anymore now that the climate had changed so much. Other hackers, a few, let's say, thought that it might be good to go in the other direction and attempt to gain clout with the government and telco security by inviting them onto a bulletin board that was set up under the auspices of creating a dialogue between hackers and security people and the FBI and Secret Service. Well, might sound a little ridiculous to think about, but the FBI thought it was great because it gave them a chance to chat with hackers and then arrest them. So it was really convenient for everyone involved.
Go straight to jail.
One-stop shopping.
Exactly. I personally had a big problem with this, not only with the security consultancy that was set up in Texas, but also with the fact that Eric Bloodaxe thought it would be a really great idea to try to bring back LOD for what it was. In the absence of any real leadership in the group anymore, because anyone who mattered anymore had withdrawn, he basically appointed himself leader of the group, which is why whenever you read old stories in the media, it says LOD versus MOD. A lot of that was bolstered by he himself, in addition to the media and the government later.
Well, Freiber, we do need to move this along, but yeah. just to summarize, you had a situation where this member of LOD narked on various people in New York because, according to him, he felt his business was in danger and he had to do something, and I think he later said he was sorry that you got caught up in all that. Is that right?
I mean, to make a long story short, it became known to even other LOD members who were wondering if I had heard anything about Eric Bloodaxe, because they were concerned for their own safety when they heard about what happened with some hackers in Australia and others and suspected that he was involved. But he was trying to gain clout with the government to bolster his business, and in doing so was turning in hackers. When hackers found out he was doing this, they began harassing him and his business and so on, which is, you know, what hackers do in general, and certainly someone who's informing on other hackers is going to earn the wrath of other hackers. So he decided that I was responsible for this based on some previous disagreements we had had, and decided that he was going to inform on me and various of my friends here in New York by giving information to the FBI about us and so on and so forth. Ultimately, as Emmanuel said, and which is interesting because it goes in line with what Bernie said, is that after some time passes, and I guess these people have a guilty conscience, they try to contact you and clear their conscience by apologizing. There is no apology for sending me to prison for a year. I'm sorry, but there just isn't.
And interesting footnote to all of this. After that whole escapade, within your own loosely organized group, Masters of Deception, MOD, you had not one but two informants.
Yeah, so as things fell apart, EFF was supporting us to go to trial. They felt that we were not guilty of what the U.S. attorneys were saying we did. There was even at least one attempt by one of the complainants in the case, British Telecom TimeNet, wanting to actually interview us, which, if we were given the opportunity, would have shown cooperation and would have given us the opportunity to tell them exactly what we did. We would have met the engineers that built the network. They were interested how we defeated their security. Sounds like a movie. But unfortunately, the U.S. Attorney's Office did not allow them to do this. So we were never given the opportunity to clear our name. So we were basically treated like criminals. And due to that fact, one by one, the guys that were named in the indictment, decided to plead guilty until I was the only one remaining. And it's, you know, the typical cliche of the last guy standing without a chair when the music stops. And what happened was two guys, some people are familiar with Julio and Alan, who was the person that Bernie was referring to, decided to testify against me. And as a result, they never did any time. They never did any time in prison to this day, which is ironic because in the indictment itself, they're among the people that are named the most.
This is typical.
This is typical because I'm a well-known personality, I guess some would say, of some kind of celebrity status. The U.S. Attorney's Office wanted to use that fact to take advantage of that fact.
To set an example,
as the judge said in the case. And as a result, they were willing to deal with the people who had the most to lose in the indictment, who were charged with the most counts in the indictment, in order to use me as the scapegoat and succeed in prosecuting somebody to make the corporations happy.
Well, now we have, I think, three of the most interesting stories in hacker history right up here on stage. I don't think you've ever all been on stage at the same time, so that's an amazing thing right there.
Dr. Feiber, I just want to ask a quick question.
Yeah.
Were you given an opportunity by the federal government to provide substantial assistance or any kind of assistance to them in providing information about others they might want to prosecute?
No, actually, I refused to cooperate with the government completely.
Right. And what I'm saying is, did they send you a proffer letter or anything like that?
No, they never sent me a letter or anything like that because I made it clear early on through my attorney that I was not willing to cooperate, and my sentence was actually longer because of that fact.
Yeah,
I was willing to accept that.
I got a proffer letter as well, and I just did not respond to it. I'll take responsibility for my own actions. I will not speak for or about anyone else. They take revenge. They're vengeful about that. When you refuse, they take that personally.
It's a lot of pressure to put on people, and obviously a lot of people crack. We've seen that happen, and that's why there are so many informants in the community. I wish we'd given this panel 2 hours. We have another 30 minutes, but we have so much ground to cover. I'm sure you've all heard of the latest case, which probably many of you are here for, concerning the keynote speaker here at HOPE, Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. An interesting story that is behind that, where this kid in the Army was allegedly releasing classified information, including videotapes that were very damning to the U.S. military. What wound up happening, according to a report in Wired, is that this particular person in the Army befriended somebody within the hacker community and proceeded to tell him all kinds of interesting things. And that person in the hacker community felt compelled to turn him in. Now, I've been told by many, many people that it's insane to dive into this. That even though this is happening right here at HOPE, that we have the keynote speaker running WikiLeaks involved in this, we have the person who turned in the person who leaked the information.
The alleged, yes.
He did turn him in.
Oh, no, you turned in the, and you were about to...
I was getting to the alleged, yes. We have to use alleged all the time.
Be very clear.
I'm not
here.
A lawyer. We have that person who has been attending the conference. Should we avoid the controversy, or should we dive right into it? I say, of course, we dive right into it. We confront this thing head on, right? But it involves a leap of faith, and I have that faith in you guys being civil, listening, coming to your own conclusions, letting people who we disagree with, we may disagree with severely, have their say so that we can judge for ourselves, and not just based on what we're told by our friends, what we're told in the mass media. I get into arguments with people on both sides of the spectrum because I don't like being told how I should feel, what I should say. All right, I want to reach that conclusion myself, and that's going to involve asking questions of everybody. So, do we all agree that we're going to let this guy have his say in a civil manner? And I think we also need to acknowledge it takes a lot of balls to show up in a crowd that's potentially very hostile and stand your ground, no matter what you think of what he stands for or what he did. All right? Do we agree on that, too? All right. With that, I'd like to introduce Adrian Lamo, and we'll let him say his piece, ask some questions, and hopefully learn something. Adrian. All right, you can boo. Go ahead.
Let's go.
Good day, friends, neighbors, and opponents. Although I would say from the get-go, I don't feel that I'm the opponent of anybody in this crowd. You may feel differently, and I respect your right to do so. But before I dive in to the WikiLeaks-related controversy, I want to go back